Welcome. This is the Digital Ethnorarity panel. My name is Liza Sabater, and I'm founder of Culture Kitchen, which is one of the banes of the existence of the extreme right in the United States and sometimes of the progressive movement as well. And I am, I have butterflies right now, but I am thrilled to be presenting this panel, Digital Ethnorarity, and opening a discussion about what is diversity, what is exclusion, and all of that. I just want my panelists to introduce themselves really quickly, and then I'm going to go into a quick introduction, and then they will give their presentations. So, Minnie, do you want to start?
Sure. I'm Minnie Callon from Level Playing Field Institute.
I'm Bianca Ramos from Crosby High School in Waterbury. I've been working with the Center for 21st Century Skills.
My name is Samantha Velez. I'm also a student at Crosby High School in Waterbury, Connecticut, and I also work with Center for 21st Century Skills.
My name is Steve Wilmarth, and I'm the director of the Center for 21st Century Skills.
Excellent. And Chris Robb was supposed to be here, but unfortunately he had a family emergency, so we will miss him and his numbers, unfortunately. So what is the Digital Ethnorarity? Let's just go right into it. You know, I've been for years now trying to, back in 2004, 2005, Nichelle Stephens and I created a series of meetups called Brown Bloggers. And this was after a series of panels of bloggers that happened in New York City where basically the only person of color happened to be Anil Dash, and who I love, and, you know, it's my peeps. But, at that time, several of us already had been online for years. I actually never intended to be a technologist. I have a background in I used to be a Latin American literature teacher. I happened by accident a co-conspirator and producer of my husband's knit art. His name is Mark Napier. And I helped produce several of his knit art pieces, Digital Landfill, The Distorted Barbie, Knit Flag. And so I just happened into this vortex of knit art that was happening in New York in the 1990s. And I knew, people of color who, had, like Ricardo Dominguez, for example, who were hacktivists, who were completely, immersed in digital culture, but were never tapped as experts or as people who knew anything about the field. And so by 2004, we were trying to come up with a term to describe these people who were colored and, or ethnic minority, basically minorities who knew about technology and who were experts in the field. And it wasn't until last year that I came with the name Digital Ethnorarity, because what I want to describe is people who are colored not just by race or ethnicity, but also by social political identification, right? There's a difference between, being an ethnic minority because of demographics, but there's also a political intention when you describe yourself in a certain way, especially online. And one of the points that I like to make about this is that I don't have to call myself black. My mom is white. Both my parents are Puerto Rican. My father is black. My mother is white. And to me, very early on when I was a child, it was a political statement to say, I'm a Puerto Rican black woman. And so digital ethnorarity are people who identify themselves, that it is an intention, and that hip, well, who doesn't want to be hip, right? It means that we are early adopters. There's a lot of people of color who are early adopters of technology, who are creating immensely rich digital cultures, not just in the United States, but all over the world. And I'm going to tap into that really quickly. And we're there. We're here. you know, most of the time, well, outside of South by Southwest, let's put it this way, because South by Southwest is just a world in itself. The diversity in South by Southwest is amazing. But, you know, outside of spaces like this, in a lot of technology conferences, we are absent. And wired, not just by gadgets, not just by software, but, you know, we're using these Web 2.0 technologies for socially as well. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the case with photolog.net. So, and, you know, when I think of digital ethnorati, I cannot make this point. I'm going to get in trouble for making this point, but I'm going to make this point anyway. We have here two Indian American men, Anil Dash, Om Malik, and I consider Anil Dash digital ethnorati because of what of the things that he has written and his his vision as vice president of business development for Six Apart. And I think that the work that Anil does is amazing. Om Malik is more known as a venture capitalist. He's more immersed in the intrinsicacies of finance and capital. And he really is not, I'm at least not on my experience. This is my personal experience. It doesn't have to be reality. But he's not involved in this discussion about what is diversity or exclusion, or, you know, what are we in terms of this new economy that is being generated online. So I don't see that coming from somebody like, you know, a place like GigaOM, but I see it coming from a place like Dash's or Six Apart. So this poses interesting questions. So if I am here, if we are here, and there's quite a number of digital ethnorati in the audience, and, you know, I want you all guys to stand up later and present yourselves. What is access? There's a question about access. What is access, right? Is diversity the issue, or is competition the issue? And I'm talking about business competition. I'm talking about competition for VC money and for access to resources. And that poses a question, are we talking of digital divide or digital exclusion? And that poses an interesting dilemma, because the hardest question is, are people of color, and our minorities, and especially in this country, only good as consumers, not as producers, and not as partners in businesses? And that's a question that was raised especially recently. Bank of America wants to start an initiative to issue credit cards to undocumented workers in the United States. Unfortunately, the term for them is illegal immigrants in the main media. And they're saying that it is a market that needs to be tapped for the existence of their business, for the business to survive. Because $40 billion annually go out of the United States thanks to undocumented workers. That's about 40 Oprahs. So, so, you know, that's a big chunk of money. So are we only good as consumers, or can we be also partners in business development? This issue is not new. I'm not bringing an issue that is new. Ars Electronica in 2002 had a festival that was art as the scene of global conflicts. NetFlag, the art piece that I helped produce, was in this show out in Linz. And Michael Jensen wrote a really, really interesting article, Wiring Africa, posing, and you can see, the so-called digital divide as it applied to Africa. And one of the points that he made in this article was, you know, if digital divide is about access to computers, why is it then that they are treated as luxury items? And why is it that especially cell phones, which are absolutely intrinsic nowadays to the development of African economy, are still considered luxury goods, right? And taxed higher. So what kinds of barriers to entry is that producing? So these are questions because, you know, as somebody who has been very privileged to see the explosion of the internet, to see the explosion of the blogosphere, and what Web.2 can do. I've actually been able to have conversations with people who are, you know, at the cutting edge of this, you know, new economy. And early on, there was a company called Photolog. They were the precursors to Flickr. And Photolog is a very interesting case, and because it was created by two guys in New York City. One of them was Scott Hefferman. I can't remember the name of the other guy. And, you know, it was basically a service for sharing photographs. And this is from the Wayback Machine. So sorry that there's all these images missing. But this is from the Wayback Machine. And you can see that on that front page, almost all the names are in American names or English names, English language names. All the links on the front page are USA people. This is April 2002, about a month after they opened shop. By 2004, Brazilians took over Photolog. And this took them completely by surprise. They were totally freaked out. And there was a panel discussion out in New York City at the Apple store, where this guy was the CEO of Photolog was saying, we had no idea. We actually had to go out and find somebody in Brazil to help us deal with this, because we didn't, where did all these people come from? Right? It's just two guys, you know, have been college buddies, and they started this business, and well, they started this service, not thinking about who were the peoples that might have ended up using it. And I found that really interesting. The panel was at the end of April 2004. By May 2004, look at how different that page looked like. It really, and actually what happened was that the percentage of Brazilian users ended up being higher than American users. And so now you have this. And as you can see, Mozambique, Mexico, there's not an American link in the front. Right? So I find that really fascinating. And the same thing happened with Orkut. Does anybody remember Orkut? Right? Same thing happened with Orkut. And it was bilial, the kind of reaction that happened in Orkut, because all these Americans were saying, what are these Brazilians coming in here? Who are they to talk to me and to write to me in Portuguese? I mean, it was amazing. And this was like really, you know, up on the, you know, technosphere for a while, right? And I wrote about it on my blog at Culture Kitchen, but I found, and I actually referenced this article because it's just absolutely brilliant. Well, and I didn't translate it. I will translate it. So when I post these, I will translate this article. It's an article that appeared in Web Insider, Brazil, and it's O Homem Cordial e Desprendimento Brasileiro. It means the cordial man. And Brazilian, giving, desprendimento is like, you know, giving yourself away. That's the terminology there. And one of the points that he actually talks about Sergio Buarque de Holanda, which was it's one of the top sociologists in Brazil, and he Homem Cordial is a term from one of his books. And the point that he makes is that because Brazilians are a mestizo culture, they're African, they're European, they're Native American, they are more likely to try to make personal connections with other peoples, no matter what their race or ethnicity, because they don't see them as others. They see them as part of their, of who they are. And so their use of, and this is interesting because I think this is really relevant to uses of technology. Orkut was supposedly about creating clicks, right? And the point that they were making in this article is that Brazilians don't treat social networking sites as being about clicks. It's about being able to replicate themselves and become popular no matter what. And in this article says, you know, talk badly about me, but at least you're talking about me. Right? Like that's the kind, and the point that they're making is that there's no mathematical algorithm that you can create in order to measure that. There's no artificial intelligence that you can create in order to adapt that to technology. You need Brazilians, or you need to have people who represent these other, potential markets that will be using your technology and your web services. And often, we are not included in those discussions. And this brings me to, you know what that is? Yeah, the $100 laptop, one laptop per child program. I am really conflicted about this program. And the only thing I'm going to ask is, given that, you know, and he's the founder of MIT, but Nicholas Negroponte is the brother of John Negroponte. And if you don't know who he is, you should Google him. And I'm a political blogger, so, you know, I have problems with John Negroponte. so you can also know that I'm from the left, not a Republican. Is one laptop per child about accelerating globalization and making it possible to create new markets of consumers? Or is one laptop per child a project for creating new business and development partners all over the world? And that's a good question because that's part of the board. And I'm gonna leave it at there. So Minnie, you got it.
So it's my desire that when I die, people will think of me as colored and hip and wired, whether they do today or not. that is hella cool. So as I mentioned before, I'm Minnie Callon, and I work at the Level Playing Field Institute, and I am international in more ways than one. Level Playing Field Institute works on issues of the United States, and I'm going to try to bring both of those into my talk because both those are part of my life. So my life in the U.S., trying to understand the issues here. I'm an immigrant. I came when I was 18. I've been here for a very long time. But my life as an international being with my family in India, my partner is British. He spent many years of his life in South Africa, so I have to bring some of that in as well. Okay, so Level Playing Field Institute works from the classroom to the boardroom, and we reveal and remove barriers to leveling the playing field in higher education and professional workplaces. So we really look and we ask the question that I asked when I came to the United States, is it in fact a level playing field? And when I came to the United States, I chose to come here. I'm very privileged in that way. I chose to come here to this country because I looked at it as the ideal for a level playing field. And I thought, well, this is where you go and you can just be what you want to be. I have to say that I still think if you want to take a relativistic view, that's still certainly the case. It's a question I have to keep answering from my family in India who hate it when I criticize U.S. domestic policy. So that's true, but who cares about relativity? Let's talk about where we want to go, really. Okay, so let's just jump into some strong language. And I can jump into that because of who Liza is. Thank you for giving me that permission. So I love this reframing as digital exclusions, and there are two points I want to make. One is I want to talk about standards and real competition. When I talk about competition, I'm not just talking about competition for bucks. I'm talking about competition in the realm of talent, your perception of talent, in the realm of intelligence, your perception of intelligence, in the realm of creativity, your perception of creativity, in the realm of innovation and your perception of innovation. So the question, when you say digital divide, what that does, and over the years, what that's done to us, myself included, I have to say, I mean, Liza, you know, poked me out of this domain, is that it sort of implies that there is a standard already, and it's about how do you get people to that standard. And that's what we're trying to dismantle here, I think, when we talk about digital exclusion, and perhaps when we talk about access more than just the digital divide. So if you're talking about access to tools, absolutely, people need access to many things they don't have access to. But we're talking about actually opening up the sphere and saying, well, if people just have access and you let the standard go, then you open up the realm for new standards to be created. And that takes you to the second point, which can be scary, and it is scary for me, so I speak from my perspective, and that is that it opens up the space for real competition. I grew up a very privileged child in India. I went to the top schools also because I did well in exams, but, you know, also because of what my father did. The issue is, if you open it up, if all the opportunities I got in India were opened up to the billion people in India, would I still be top of my class? And that scares the hell out of me, quite honestly. But I think that is the question that we need to be asking here. And we need to be asking it in the context of the about 35% native-born people of color of the U.S. who are really absent in the conversations we hear when we talk about the lack of technology talent. So Bill Gates just went and talked to the Congress or the Senate or one such house, and he talked again about the fact that the visa issue, the immigration issue, is really affecting tech talent. But in all those conversations, and I've heard those conversations by folks from MIT and Stanford at the Innovation Conference, you know, a year or two ago, everybody talks about the lack of foreign talent, but nobody's talking about the missing faces, the missing 30 to 35% faces that are of the native-born people of color. And that, if we let them really have access, maybe you're scared about the color of innovation that comes about. So just to illustrate it, I do want to talk about one of our initiatives at Level Playing Field Institute. I want to show you just a little bit of a video. Hopefully we'll get some sound as well. Can you see that? Okay. This is actually a video done by Zari Diaz, who spoke, I don't know if she's here right now, and it's with the Jet Set Show. And this is a group of our high school students who are part of a technology initiative called Smashcast. And you can go to smashcast.org. I'll give you the URLs at the end. Hang on. Let me see. Oops.
She was talking about the editing. What goes into this?
Well, it's all quite simple. We primarily work through podcast. So we just download the sound editing software called Audacity. It's open source. And we use a microphone to just record our audio into the computer, save it, and we can publish it from there.
So how do you guys come up with your ideas? Is there a round table? How does it happen?
Well, it's like you said, it's a round table. We all come together, we brainstorm any ideas, put on the table, then we take a vote and we work on the podcast that we decided on.
All right, that's it for now, but you can certainly see the video online. But what I wanted to leave you with from this part is Vincent Jones, when he talks about downloading Audacity, searching the web, putting up things, who does he scare? Does he scare anyone? And Vincent Jones is the talented young man who spoke about podcasting in the beginning. Okay, so the next point that I want to make, and the last one before my colleagues begin speaking, is about national versus international. So I brought up the fact that I have these dual personalities. I have multiple dual personalities. The other one is related to Second Life, but that's not a conversation for this panel. But talk to me after that. But national versus international. So there are two issues here, I think. One is degree of access, and I'm going to make some big generalizations, but I think they hold. So degree of access, there's no question that when you go to a country like India, in terms of the number of people, there's a huge lack of access in a way that just isn't matched by the states. So I think we do need to look at level of access. Certainly, you know, Africa is currently the continent du jour. And that's why I'm very consciously choosing India, by the way, because I do want to call out when something like Africa is just what you use as your proxy, and I'm going to use it in a moment in a different way, so forgive me for that. But so the degree of access is really important. The second point, though, is the impact of lack of access. And that's where all of a sudden the national issue becomes even more important, because here we start playing into stereotypes. And stereotypes exist both positive and negative. But what happens in this country is different from lack of access for an Indian in India, because on the whole, I've seen replicas of people that sort of look like me, the O'Mullicks of the world, and they're out there and they're leading. I have no issue with stereotypes. If at all, the stereotypes will bin me as you're a math person, you're a science person, and that's a little annoying, but what's the big whoop in the grand scheme of things? Whereas, indeed, if you think about the impact of stereotypes play and that added on to the lack of access in this country for the African-American community and indeed for the Latino community, you've got a real problem there that then becomes really huge. And it's separate from sort of the degree of access. So I think we need to keep both those pieces in mind. The other piece about international, though, is I do want to talk about, give you an example of one group. This is probably one of the most interesting social movements in South Africa. And this is just an example of how when technology is sort of, is when access is given to groups that have very little, the kinds of things that they can do. This is a group called Abatlali Base Jondolo, and I'm sure I'm mispronouncing it, though I'm trying very hard. Here I speak as a proxy for my partner, Raj Patel, from whom I've gotten permission to talk about this, and he's gotten permission from Abatlali because they are a very democratic organization. They're about 40,000 people strong. They're an organization of various shack dwellers fighting for rights in South Africa. They have been using this website as a Drupal-based site that was indeed created by others than those living in the shacks. They don't have internet connection. And to place it in context, when they talk about internet connectivity in the universities in South Africa, they say all of South Africa has the connectivity of Berkeley. So, I mean, that's still what we're talking about. These are people that, let me just show a little bit of this. I mean, this is their life. If this is not going to work, I'm just going to keep going on. But the point is that this website has given them somewhat of a level playing field with the misrepresentations of their own elected representatives. So, for example, their current elected leader, Sibu Zikode, has been called a maniac, a third force person. And if you know anything about South Africa, that has really bad connections to the apartheid period. So the third force was this sort of manipulated group, and the idea was that they were sort of the splinter group, but they were funded by the and supported by the white majority. So that was a pretty dangerous statement. So because they can use a website such as this, they get access. The other thing they do is they talk about... they use the cell phones a lot, although it's very expensive. They use it as much as possible, and it's their lifeline. They use it as, like you would call 911. And so if you actually go through the Abatlali site, you'll see examples of how Sabu is down on the floor in with the, you know, the police have pulled him in, and the only way he's getting a message out is through a cell phone he still happens to have. And he's, I'm okay, how's Cindy, who's his wife? So it's a whole new way of using texting. It has lots of implications, even in terms of collecting news. And so I encourage you to go to their site as well, just to get a sense of what they're doing. And lastly, although I said the site was created, obviously, by people that have access to the technology, my partner included, the question you should be asking is, what was the relationship between the creators of the site and the group? You should be asking that question. As I said, the good news is they always check in with the group, which is the way that one needs to do it. And I put this quote up here because I think this is how those of us, myself included, with privilege, can come to this conversation. So, Zikode is the elected representative, and this is in a newspaper article in the Mail and Guardian. He was unimpressed by an account of actually another NGO head. He says, Abatlali appreciate the tremendous work of this group, but it should remember that we have chosen the center and the people we will work with. Richard Pithouse, Richard Ballard, and Raj Patel came to us as servants, not masters. And I'm just going to leave you with that thought, because it's not as if we don't want to do things to help, but I think the way we approach the issue, giving tools and then being, you know, working as servants and not masters in that relationship, is really what we need to aspire for. It's not easy, but I think that's where we should go.
Stephen, yes. Why don't we start?
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Liza. I'm just going to ask a favor of my other guest here who's online. Barbara, if you can hear me, would you wave? Just wave at the camera, please. Thank you. All right. Just making sure we got a connection. Hang on, and we'll be right with you, Barbara. Thank you. Okay. My name is Steve Wilmarth, and when Liza asked me to come down here today to be on this panel. I know Liza is very inclusive, and her politics reflect that, and I am her token white male for the panel. So. what I want to do is I'm going to just make a brief introduction of my guests, because they're really the story here. And again, in support of what we're talking about as far as the digital ethnorati is concerned. But let me begin with another good-hearted white male, Jimmy Wales, the man behind Wikipedia. And his vision, of course, is that every person on the planet be given free access to the sum of all human knowledge, and that Wikipedia has been described as an exercise in the democratization of that knowledge. Now, that's high-sounding language, and what we want to do as a panel, or as a group on this panel, is talk about that question a little bit, because it does open up some real issues. What do we mean by democratization, and how serious are we about that? Wikipedia is also seen as being at the forefront of this thing called Web 2.0, characterized by the new literacies of the 21st century of inclusion, collaboration, and participation. So, with that, let me see if this comes up. I guess I have to hit it again. What's at stake in this democratization process? And a couple of bullet items: the culture, obviously, of the online community, and the implications for education. And that's where the Center for 21st Century Skills puts its efforts and its energies into education. And our students come from a broad spectrum. What we're all about is trying to bring together students from basic, what we call racially and economically isolated areas. So we're bringing together suburban students in year-long collaborative projects with urban students and rural students. And access is a critical issue for us to do the work we want to do and have a fair level playing field. So the opportunities for collaborative learning in a globally connected world, what are they? And this is at stake, again, as part of this question. Who has the knowledge in today's global community? That's a big question, because you can ask the folks at Stanford and MIT and Harvard, and they may give you one answer, and then you go into the communities and ask them, and you may get a very different answer. What does it mean to be discerning in today's online world? And again, with the kinds of media exposure that our people get at all levels and all walks of life. I mean, if you watch Lou Dobbs, you've got one perspective about how to be discerning when it comes to an issue like immigration, and yet if you talk to people who are in the immigrant community, you'll get a totally different perspective. We need to teach our children how to discern the difference between points of view. If content can be created and distributed cheaply, what are the implications for cultural awareness and identity? And that, again, as we've heard in the panel so far, there is a real question of what do we mean by cultural awareness in a free and open exchange of ideas across the internet. And these questions of what's at stake go to the core of economics, and we might hear frequently the phrase, it's all about the free market, that the free market is at work here, and I question the idea of the free market in the internet and where that's taking us. I have to wonder, as Liza has expressed in her message, are we being looked at as consumers in the free market, or are we being looked at as producers? And what is the real role of people participating in the internet? Or on the web, rather. So you're going to just see some flash pictures. I'll just chat for a minute while these pictures flash across the screen. Representative of the students we work with, and again, we need to talk about access. You'll hear from the young ladies on the panel here and from our guest from Brazil that access is indeed a critical issue. The good example is when you talk about the city of Philadelphia wanting to wire up its communities, all of its communities, on an equal footing basis. In other words, creating a Wi-Fi net across the city of Philadelphia. The first people to come to the table and protest that that's unfair are not the people in the neighborhoods. It's Verizon. They are the first people to raise their hand and say, that's not fair. We have profits at stake. You can't be giving people free access without considering our property rights. So these are questions that, again, permeate every educational institution, particularly K through 12. And if you go into any urban school today, you are more likely to get a lockdown of your internet and your access than you are an open capability. That's not just true in the inner city. It is also true in our suburban schools to a large measure. But it's particularly acute in our urban and rural school districts. So my guest, I want to introduce to you, I'm going to introduce Bianca Ramos and Samantha Valise. I'd like them to share with you some of their stories. They represent this leading edge, the edge of this digital, native, cultural wave that is overwhelming most of our gatekeeping community, our hard community. But I also want to introduce another guest to you, and I'll use, let's just pop out here for a moment. I have another guest coming in, and let's just do this right. First, I will show you where we're from, and in particular, the high school that Bianca, Samantha, and Barbara Almeida are from. Barbara Almeida is our guest up in the left-hand corner from Brazil. But let me zero in on Crosby High School in Waterbury, Connecticut, through the miracle of Google Earth. And that's where we all started from in our journey here today. But let us go now to Barbara's home in Annapolis, Brazil. And I will let Barbara tell you why Annapolis is now her home, where most recently, up until this past month, her home was in Waterbury, Connecticut with her mother and father. They're now a split family. And this is in Annapolis, Brazil. So Barbara is now... I think about 4,300 miles away from her home in Waterbury, Connecticut. So I'm going to connect Barbara. I'm going to unmute this. And Barbara, can you hear me? Barbara, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. I'm going to just expand this. Okay.
And by the way, have you seen all the technology we've been using? just keeping it out there.
Okay. Bianca?
First of all, I'd like to ask everybody in the audience, could you please give Barbara a round of applause? She is taking a lot of time out of her busy, busy schedule over there in Brazil. Thank you, Barbara. We love you.
Bem-vinda.
I guess we're here because we are prime examples of digital ethnarchy. We come from a place where access is very limited, and we all went to Crosby High School, Barbara, Samantha, and myself, and they presented us with this technology class where we were working with the Center for 21st Century Skills and IBM, and what they did was they posed a problem. They asked us to solve a problem based on health, environment, something that would help our community. So they put us together in groups and told us to go, basically. So you could imagine the frightened looks on our faces when they said that to us, because none of us had ever worked with this type of technology. Some of us had never worked with people in the groups. We were kind of like confused as to what to do next. But it ended up being a really good project, and what we did was we decided to create a book online, almost like Wikipedia, kind of like SparkNotes, but a little bit away from that. What we wanted to do was take our personal notes and put them into TK3. I'm not sure if any of you are familiar with that. But we did that, and that basically allows you to input text and highlight and make sticky notes. It's kind of like a notebook that's online. And we made it free and accessible to everyone in our high school. And basically what we wanted to do was eliminate books because of the program that the three of us were in. And
it's extremely rigorous. The three of us are in a highly accelerated class. We all take college prep courses. And basically we came up with this idea. We were being selfish. We take home at least 6 books a night, and we have at least 5 hours of homework ahead of us when we get out at 2. You can imagine, her and I work, she works at Dunkin' Donuts, I work at Pretzel Time. we
so
worked
they
about...
still have to work in order to contribute to the family. Just
exactly.
To put that out.
During the Christmas season, her and I worked about between 30 to 35 hours, plus being full-time students and doing 5 hours of homework. So we were basically going to bed maybe 2 o'clock at night, getting up at 6 and doing it all over again the next day. This program, basically, when we wanted to create this book because the way our school is divided is it's remedial, level one, level two, honors, and then ACE, the Academic Choice for Excellence, which is the program that we're in. We wanted to eliminate that. Well, that's all great and all that we're divided. We don't like that because it's not giving all the other students an equal chance that we're given. We don't learn, you know, the same way. Our textbooks and stuff are more in depth than theirs, and it's not fair. While we were working on this project, we didn't have internet access for about 4 to 5 months.
And mind you, the entire program was based online. The only way we could get a hold of our project directors was online. The only way that we could talk to, you know, our mentors or anything was online, or even talk to each other was online. And we had no type of online access at our school for 4 months. So
you could only imagine how difficult that was. We were basically doing everything by phone.
Yeah. So, again, the point of the book was we realized that everybody learns differently. Some people are visual. They need to see something, you know, popping out at them. Something needs to draw their attention. And other people like to read, and that's the way they learn, and that's perfectly fine. And then other people need to hear things, read them, and see them at the same time, or else it's just not going to click. And pretty much I work that way. So what we did was we had audio and visual components online with the notes. So it worked well because, say, if you had missed that class one day, you could go online and watch the class, watch your teacher give the lecture, and, you know, you could pick up certain points that you need to, you know, pass a test or write an essay or whatever.
Which in turn left no student behind, which was what our goal was trying to be.
And I'll just add that, you know, so the outcome of this project was a community-generated textbook, Now, one of the major problems in our school systems today is the cost of operating schools and the cost of and how those costs are divided up. How much money goes to actually helping this, working with the students, versus how much money goes to people who are selling the products that the school system relies on. Textbook industry, of course, is one of those major stakeholders in public education. And so the students created a textbook that was community-generated, culturally acclimated, and you know, more than adequate from a vetting perspective. When we took that textbook to the State Department of Education for approval, the natural response is, who wrote it? Students. It's no good. We can't use it. So this is part of the question that's on the table. The issue is, what is good information? Information that can be, knowledge that can be massaged and worked on, as in the wiki format, the Wikipedia format, is proven to be every bit as relevant and accurate as any gatekeeper model, Britannica, et cetera. So that's the part of the background. But go ahead, guys. Tell the story of what happened during your high-stakes testing this week.
I just want to say that it's okay that they denied us that, and that they said that it wasn't accurate, because we're going to try something else, and I'll get back to that in a minute. But Barbara, I'd like for you to explain to everyone why it is that you are in Brazil right now and why you're not here with us at South by Southwest.
Can you hear us, Barbara?
I can't hear that well.
Okay, what I'm going to do is it looks like it's frozen up here. Let me see if I can change it.
In the meantime, Steve had asked us to
Barbara,
explain to you guys.
I'll call you back.
Okay.
In the meantime, Steve had asked us to tell you what happened during this week back home in Connecticut. And we're in the middle of taking the CAP test. It's required for all sophomores. Her and I are juniors, so thank God we don't have to worry about it, because those tests were, like, horrible. But was it Thursday?
You're such a nerd.
We are, but, you know.
You know, we love it. We're nerds,
colored,
and it's great.
Hip, wired nerds. Thank you.
So during our week there, Thursday, we are in our chemistry class, and our principal, we're noticing that there's tons of fire trucks coming. There's people in hazmat suits. There's, you know, police department, and we're like, what in the world?
These people are running frantically into our school building, and there's no one coming over the intercom.
And our principal, yeah, she totally didn't say anything for like 10 minutes, and we're like, okay, so do we leave, or is something going on? And comes to show that we are in lockdown mode. We had a code red. We were in code red for about 4.5 hours, and obviously there was a mercury spill in our school. So yeah.
But it didn't come from the school. Someone brought mercury into our school.
And spilled it.
And before, okay, so yes. So okay. These people are running into our building.
We have 10 minutes left. Oh, so goodness.
Let's let Barbara try.
Barbara?
Okay. Barbara, can you hear us?
Yeah.
Okay.
I can hear you, not the girls.
Okay, Barbara, can you just explain to our guests, please, why it is that you're in Brazil and that you can't be here with us?
Can you explain why you're in Brazil, Barbara?
Well, what happened was my parents basically wanted to give us a better life, a better education, try something new. So they decided to go to the U.S. and see how it would be. So I started in sixth grade at Wallace Middle School. It was extremely hard because I'm at a new place, not knowing the language, not knowing anyone. So little by little, I got used to everything and everyone. I began in bilingual, and then I moved to ESL classes. I began all the way in group 4, and then moved to group 3, 2, 1, and so on. When I got to eighth grade, I heard about this program called ACE, and then I decided to join it. I was like, why not? I'll try. I mean, I don't know English that well, but why not? So I applied for it. There was this whole process. I had to write an essay, and I ended up getting in. So that's where I met Samantha and Bianca, which was their freshman year. I didn't know them that well, and then we had classes together in ACE, and we were in the program, this program that they told you about, the ITLA program, in which we had to create this new product, and that's where we came together.
Tell us about the reason you're back in Brazil at this point is because...
Yeah, unfortunately, our passport expired, and I had to return with my mom and my brother.
And your dad is where?
He's still in the U.S.
Okay. And he's there for work, and you're back because your education couldn't go any further?
Yeah, I couldn't go to college there.
You couldn't go to college unless you had the proper legal status, correct?
Correct.
It's okay, Barbara.
It's okay, Barbara.
I'd like you all to know
that. It was hard, but I had to leave everyone behind. And I actually even thought about, I emailed Steve, and I was like, I'm sorry, but I can't continue on with the project because I'm going back to Brazil. I don't know how we're going to interact, you know. I won't be able to talk to you guys. I won't be there to go to the conferences. So Steve emails me back, and he tells me, don't worry about it. We have the internet. I can connect with you, and you could still be at the conferences like I am today. So the internet is playing a big part in me staying in the program and keeping in touch with all my friends and my dad that's all in the United States.
I don't have a lot of time left, so I'm just going to open it up to questions or comments that anybody may have. And after the panel, we're going out to Rio Grande Cafe, so if you all want to come and continue the conversation, you can. But let's just take a moment of pause right now and see who wants to ask a question or make a comment or not.
Who? Oh, don't forget to make sure that you guys go and
use the microphone to ask questions, please.
The microphone, please.
My name is Chris Smith, and I have a question. I worked in higher ed for 5 years, and I'm now pursuing an MBA in digital media management. We study the very convergent issues that you're kind of speaking of. My question, though, is as I've worked in higher ed over the past 5 years, and mostly, I went down to the Valley in Texas, and let me tell you, I was by far the only black person down there, and so everybody wanted to touch my skin because they'd never seen somebody like me in a while. What I found in my work over the 5 years in my MBA program is that I guess my question to you would be, do you think, in terms of being a consumer versus being one who is a partner in the business, do you think it has more to do with also seeing those before you who are also partners rather than consumers? I know one of the deals with hip-hop culture is that those guys are all about ownership, not so much as just being the consumer being run by the label. You know, oftentimes they create clothing companies and yada, yada, yada. Right. But they're very big on that. So I was wondering on the panel, how do you guys feel about the idea of, you know, I guess people of color seeing those who come before them being more so on the producing and on the ownership side versus just being on the consumer side? Because I personally, when I grew up, and I'm 29 years old, I hardly ever saw any of that. And once I got to college and saw it, my total, you know, idea of the world totally changed once I saw that. And I was pissed because I saw it when I was about 23. Right. And I should have saw it when I was about 12.
Right. Well, you know, it's a very good question because, you know, my father worked as a consultant for over 30 years. But I never really considered it that he was an entrepreneur. Because, you know, I mean, we were not, you know, I always think of entrepreneurs as extremely rich people, right? So I never really thought about him like that. But, you know, Puerto Ricans always have to have 2 and 3 jobs. Right, and usually the second and third job are actually self-employment of some kind or another, and this happens all around, you know, the Caribbean and in most, you know, ethnic communities because you need to make ends meet. So we have to redefine entrepreneurship in our communities, and this is as much as to point out to what is problematic from the outside of the people of privilege who have capital and who have basically, you know, the connections in order to make businesses happen, as much as us taking ownership of what we have in our communities and saying, wait, we have resources, we have skills, it's just that we have to reframe them in order to come to a meeting point. And so, I mean, to me, this is a the beginning of a discussion. I actually have opened a Google group that I'm going to need the connection to this, that I would love to continue this discussion online because I think it's absolutely necessary. And hopefully we'll have a conference of the Digital Ignorati in a year or so, national conference. All colored people, hip and wired. Jason?
So my question is in practical terms, does perception matter with the types of tools that people are using in the digital divide? Like, Orkut's a successful social networking tool, but I think for the people at South by Southwest, it isn't thought of as such. Or Photolog is more popular than Flickr, but isn't perceived as such. And how does that affect what happens in the internet technology community?
You want to take that?
Well, I'll jump in just for a second and say that I think that's a really great point. I can think about, again, I'll just use the Indian example for now. I can think about lots of stuff there feeding into, you know, the billion people that is going to be bigger than anything in this country, especially if the tools remain myopic. So, you know, just focus on the U.S. And I think it is perception, and I think to some extent it's going to be at the peril of those who continue to just perceive sort of with these blinders on that it's just what's here, and just because I know it's Flickr and it's got, you know, U.S. folks on it, it's the most important thing. So perception is there, and then I think if you stick with just the perception, don't force yourself to open up, I think you're going to, you know, be in danger.
Quick comment. Yesterday, the Blogabrity panel was really interesting because Henry Copeland was basically saying that the Forbes 25 celebrities, blog celebrities or whatever, was basically a crock of shit. And because of the metrics that they used and because basically all the people on that list had access to mainstream media, right? And so it's interesting because, you know, it really poses a question, right? Of there were people that were not included in that list that had way more traffic than some of the people that were like in the 80,000 page views, you know, a month or something like that. So, but it, I, what the internet, what the web is doing is that it's accelerating. You know, there's tons of barriers to entry that have been knocked down, but we still have more. Right. Go ahead.
Hi there. My name is Daniel. I work in software for mobile phones. Online, all that. I've seen some really interesting discussions and reports and things like that saying that certainly in the U.S., I actually just heard from BET, that African Americans use mobile phones far, far more than the average.
Yes.
Double the number of voice minutes, double the data minutes.
Yes.
Better phones, and they buy them more frequently.
Nobody has done a real a poll yet, a study about that. That is like, I know somebody that did it for ESPN Mobile, but they won't release the numbers. But I was in a panel.
But it is interesting.
I'm sorry.
It is interesting that you know it.
Right.
Well, BET.
You work with BET?
No, I don't work with them. I was at an off portal show when BET was speaking. And they actually said, yes, they have done this research. Obviously, they're interested in the results themselves, not distributing it widely, per se. But they discovered that population uses it double the average. The second largest group is Latinos, and then Asians, and then sort of the mass of white people down below. So from a usage perspective.
And the percentage points are something like a 20-point spread. Between white Americans and African Americans and Latinos. I mean, it's a huge point spread.
So given that, I was wondering how you would use mobile phones, either like in your various different businesses or in education. I mean, I'm interested in I have a business that's involved in the election process and democratic processes and things like that. And I was just wondering how you would use mobile phones given that skew in the U.S.
You know, I'd like to speak a little bit to that because I think this is a critical issue. And indeed, we do see mobile phones being used in ways that are very creative and extremely ahead in the ethnic communities of where a lot of students are, younger students are in the traditional communities. But I got to tell you that the battle lines are being drawn, are they not? The battle lines are being drawn over, we talk about net neutrality as an issue, and I think my panel members would agree with me, my colleagues would agree with me. It's not about net neutrality. The problem with net neutrality is it comes up every year for renewal, if you will. And we've got to fight the battle about what content is going to cost the consumers through the net neutrality battle that forms every year in Congress. It shouldn't be about that. It should be a constitutional amendment. The access to the internet via the cell phone is a right.
It's a First Amendment right. It's a civil right. Right. We started late. I'm just going to take a couple more minutes. Absolutely. It's a civil right issue. You know, we are basically redefining civil rights on a digital scale. And I'm a woman on a warpath because these are computers. And you know what? There's a lot of people in the projects on Avenue D that have these. I don't have this. But they don't have landlines. And they don't have a computer. So for them, a $300 investment on this is way more. It's a deal. It's an absolute deal. You know, because there's so many girls in the cashiers in my supermarket that they're like, you know, sidekicking each other, you know, but that's their computer. They connect to the internet to there. They read the internet there. They email. It's not texting. It's emailing. And so this should not be a luxury good. And this should not be gatekeeped when it comes to the internet connection. It should not. And so that's you know, the intention of starting these conversations.
I just wanted to say I use my cell phone for everything when I'm away from home, especially at school, even though our cell phones are banned, because I'm constantly having to check my email with all the work that we're doing on the book project. I'm constantly having to be in contact with Steve, and just coming down here, we're constantly emailing back
we're
and
twittering
forth
each other
all over the place. So my cell phone is my life. If it didn't have internet connection, I would be screwed.
That's her internet connection, is her cell phone. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm originally from England. I've been in Texas for like 7 years, so I've never been through the educational system here, but I've had like my husband's American. Yeah, I'm very glad. And we've had lots of discussions about the diversity in American schools as opposed to English schools. I grew up in a small town in Leicestershire. There's lots of Indians there, some African Americans. We just have real diversity and no real cliques. You can go up to anyone in the school and talk to anyone. And what you were saying earlier about how you have remedial, first, second, and ACE, and is there any other ways that you can bring diversity, not just through, you know, ethnicity, but educational levels, and get people to be able to interact so when you get into the internet, people aren't just polarized. You know, Republicans talk to Republicans, and it's getting more and more polarized to different areas.
I think that's what we wanted our book project to be. We wanted our book project to be equal to everyone, because in our school there isn't any type of equality as far as our education goes.
I know, Liza, you had some stipulations with the $100 laptop, but actually we're hoping to get a portion of our book onto the laptop before it's ready to be distributed.
No, but that's important. I think that's absolutely, you know, important. And I'm going to finish up now because, you know, you are creating the content. It's not somebody giving it to you. So it is serving you. It's not mastering you. Thank you so much for being here. Our links are there.